Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 13th of May, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us on this fine, beautiful morning. Playing some Stevie Wonder this morning. He is 71 years old today, so happy birthday to Stevie Wonder. He will be our featured artist this morning on our bumper music throughout the roundtable panel. We'll have a full playlist online, as always, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. We have a great group this morning. Let me introduce them to you. A reminder before we do that, however, that you can also join us by simply writing us and sending us an email. We'd love to hear what's on your mind about the issues that we discuss today. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here, WAMC's very own. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, WAMC.
Yes. We welcome and good morning. And we want to also welcome Professor and Director of Sociology Honors Program at the Sociology, in the Sociology Department at UAlbany, Angie Chung. Good morning, Angie. How are you?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back.
Great to have you back. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you with us on the program. Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is in the house. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everyone. And you have Lloyd Price yesterday and Stevie Wonder today. I half expected after listening to Lloyd Price yesterday that the first voice I would hear out of the bumper music was Harry Harrison or Herb Oscar Anderson or Chuck Leonard. And if those names don't mean anything, then you're not as old as I am. But they were among the big DJs on WABC when it was the place to listen to music. And it's great to hear them.
That's right. And actually, we were thinking about doing Norman Lloyd this morning, but we didn't have enough.
I don't know how well he's saying.
Yeah, I don't know either. Just some good St. Elsewhere monologues would have been fine. And let's see. We also welcome Jim Henwer to the program, his second time with us this morning. And we couldn't be more more thrilled. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Deep breath. Jim Henwer. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Thanks. It's a big week in cyber, so I'm glad to be here.
Well, it is a big week. When last we met on Tuesday morning, you were still working out your issues at RPI, your place of employment. Where do those things stand with your ransomware attack or whatever it was?
Well, we don't know what it was, and it may well not have been ransomware. But the recovery is going well. You know, it's made a little difficult by the fact that due to the pandemic, we don't have a lot of people on campus. So we have to find ways of doing various things you do in these attacks when people are spread all over the place. And so it's taking a little longer than it might otherwise, but it is going well.
Excellent. Well, we welcome you all. Thank you very much. Just a quick programming note. We're going to be going till 10:30 with this wonderful group. And then at 10:30, we're going to welcome Dr. Jim Fagan to the program. He has been our COVID guy throughout the pandemic. He is a pediatric immunologist, and we'll be talking to him for about a half hour from 10:30 to 11 about what is going on in the world. And, of course, we'll be taking your questions as always. So that at 10:30 this morning. So let's get started with our group and a lot to talk about. And, of course, one of the key stories is that of the cyber attack that happened to the pipeline that is causing so many issues when it comes to the Colonial Pipeline, especially down south with gas and shortages and so forth. So while drivers are scrambling for fuel, the Colonial Pipeline said supplies would resume flowing from Texas to the East Coast in the coming days. Anxious drivers circled from one filling station to another. Gasoline prices rose, and thousands of stations were out of fuel in the southeast on Wednesday as a ransomware attack continued to cripple a vital fuel pipeline. There was a sign of relief late Wednesday when the operator of the pipeline, which transports gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel from Texas to New Jersey, said it had, quote, initiated the restart of operations, but the company, Colonial Pipeline, said supplies would take several days to return to normal. Since the pipeline was shut down on Friday, the uncertainty about supplies has prompted a growing frenzy among motorists determined to fill up. Gasoline prices in Georgia and a few other states rose 8 to 10 cents a gallon on Wednesday alone, a jump not usually seen without a major hurricane shutting down refineries. At some stations, people were filling up gasoline cans, forcing others to wait longer and causing shouting matches, you know, the good old American way. Yes. Alan, what do you think? And then we'll go to Jim.
Well, I think you ought to really go to Jim, but I can only say somebody's making money. Okay. Go to Jim.
Jim, go ahead. Where? So,
what, yeah, you know,
when you talk about restarting a restart, what is that like to reinitiate a restart?
Right. So, I don't know all the details of reinitiating an oil pipeline per se, but the cyber part of it is again. Been talking about the past couple days, stuff happening on our campus, stuff happening in some of the other attacks that have been going on, which is that, you know, you shut things down and then you bring them up slowly, checking things as you go along to make sure that you've actually addressed the problem. Because, you know, if there's bad software in your system and you bring it back up, then you just start all over again. So the recovery is often a very slow, very careful process. And so that's part of what's going on. And then the other thing is it takes a while for oil to move across the pipeline. It's worth noting that there seems to be a lot of debate over just how much of this actually has anything to do with the long gas lines and the price rises have anything to do with the pipeline per se. You know, a lot of people believe it's more like toilet paper in the early days of the pandemic, right? People just suddenly started buying it because they thought there wouldn't be any, and that, of course, made it so there wasn't any. Notice that in a lot of other parts of the place where the pipeline runs, there haven't been these problems. So it seems like where people started hoarding, things got out of hand very quickly. So the cyber aspect of it seems to be being well handled. The physical restart is slow but moving. Trucks are taking oil. Around, you know, so again, the pipeline is just a means of moving the oil. There are other means. They're just not as fast and not as efficient. So things are moving again. So it seems like, you know, the recovery is going to be fine. And the real question is, what went wrong? How do we prevent it? And, you know, how do we make sure these things don't happen again?
Alan?
Exactly. Well, exactly right, Jim. You know, Biden is the man in the middle, of course, and has put out a series of edicts on what we should be doing differently. But in the end, how do you stop this from occurring as long as people see more utility in paying the money when they're held up for ransomware than not? And we have certainly had that discussion on this show, but it is a perplexing one. You know, if you made it against the law to pay the, and boy, did when I suggested that the other day, boy, did people get angry at me. But, you know, I think that there's got to be a way of stopping it, because if you don't put some kind of a firewall up, it's going to just keep happening.
Jim?
You know, I think that's right. And I think a lot of us have been saying for a long time something needs to happen. Biden has released an executive order. It's quite long and detailed. I spent several happy hours reading it last night. Basically, it has four or five key things he's doing. He's ordering the federal government to do, because remember that one of the big problems here is that the federal government only controls a piece of this. You know, think about the energy system in Texas, which, you know, had that problem during the winter, right? Why didn't federal regulation make it so Texans didn't get clobbered by that? The answer is because Texas owns its own regulations on energy, just to a large degree. Cyber is much like that. The patchwork of laws is a mess. And so what Biden is doing is starting with all of the federal supply chain, the things that the federal government touches, anything that has federal contracting involved, mm-hmm. including now not just the software side of that. So, for example, if these pipelines are providing gas that goes into military jets, then that would be something that gets touched. And it's going to look at removing barriers to sharing some of the information, a lot of work on modernizing the federal government's cybersecurity. So in other words, if we don't fix the government systems, what right does the government have to tell industry what to do? Standardizing response, creating a review board. So it's a lot of things that people have been requesting of the government for a long time. CISA, the Cyber Infrastructure Security Agency, was set up to start addressing these things, and then Trump never really invested. So it looks like we're moving in the right direction. It looks like this is a good starting place. So a lot of us are crossing our fingers and hoping that there really will be the investment needed to make this happen.
Can I ask a naive question really quickly of you, Jim? And that is, you know, we know that there's a pipeline. We also know that that pipeline carries, as you just suggested, airline fuel and carries other things. How do they get all those different kinds of things through the same pipe?
You know, it's the same stuff, Alan, and then as it comes out, it gets processed
okay,
in different ways, is my understanding.
That's a good answer.
I'm not an expert.
That's a good answer.
That's my belief, anyway.
Yeah, that sounds
you
good.
You may be right.
Stop the band. Ira Fussfeld.
Well, I think Alan and Jim hit on several of the points I was going to make, and I believe Jim is correct. The pipeline carries the oil to a refinery is where they then treat it to the various grades. I too was struck by how quickly there was an absence of gasoline around the parts of the Southeast, and I trucked that up to hoarding that may have been premature. Although reading one of the stories this morning that said had the oil not been restored as it is now having been restored, things like the airlines would have been hit within about 10 days, which would have severely impacted travel. So the problem was real. I guess the question that I have, and we've all sort of touched on it, and Jim would be the best to answer it, is whatever they're doing now to fix it, whatever you're doing at RPI now to fix it, is there a permanent fix, or is it just simply a case of moving the deck chairs around until some bad actors are able to tap into the next firewall? Are we always going to be looking at this problem?
In addition to that, there seems to be a big debate going on about Russian complicity in all of this.
Yeah. So let me answer the first one first, Ira's point, which is that the analogy I use a lot is just take security in general, your home security, right? Are you perfectly safe at home? No. If someone wants to break in, you know, they can get in. And I've used the analogy on radio before. If you, you know, start putting more expensive stuff in your house, you might get a security system. If you're a bank, you have armed guards. But, you know, the problem doesn't go away. Banks still get robbed, but way less than they used to because we have much better security, much better understanding. You know, it pushes the cost of the robbery so high that you could only really... You know, it's only worth doing if you're either willing to take a tremendous risk for a small amount of money, that's the guy who just walks in with a gun, or whether you're, you know, able to get a huge amount of money with a lot of effort, the sort of Ocean's 11 kind of model. And, you know, cyber is going to probably move in that direction. Your home computer will have general protections. Larger systems will have to have some extra stuff. And eventually, you know, these big systems, energy, water, gas, have to be improved. And the real problem, and we saw this with the pipeline company, right? They've been being told for a very long time that they were vulnerable. But they thought that the cost of fixing it would be lower than the cost of preventing it. They were wrong. And, you know, they're learning that now. And hopefully other energy providers and such will learn the lesson from this. And if not, this executive order is going to incentivize good behavior as well as punishing bad. So we hope it'll be a start in the right direction. But, you know, I think 10, 15, 20 years from now, living with this will be like living with crime. If you live in a high crime area, you have to do different things than if you live out in the, you know, middle of the country. If you have a lot of valuables, you'll have to protect them differently than if you don't. And, you know, so the problem will never go away, but it will be significantly mitigated by people really taking it seriously and understanding what to do about it.
Angie Cheung, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone pretty much hit the nail on the head. I think, you know, certainly questions about cybersecurity is an issue. And, you know, despite Elon Musk's bad day the past few weeks and stuff, I think, you know, a lot of people, there's been a lot of chatter about to what extent we need to seek alternative energy sources. And I myself have been looking at the Tesla Cybertruck a little bit more closely than I did before. But I think one other question to ask is, you know, like Ira said, the problem is certainly real, but I wonder to what extent a lot of us have succumbed to this tendency towards mass panic and where that really comes from, right? Some of this shortage was created by all the hoarding. And so, excuse me. And so, you know, with the fact that, you know, we've had, you know, unusual circumstances the past year with the pandemic, you know, all of this has been fed by the tendency to chitter chatter on social media and, you know, combined with our distrust of government and security. So I think it'd be kind of interesting to see to what extent this kind of event will happen again.
Yeah, it's a great point. I'm going to let's pause that conversation. I'd like to have it on the other side of the break and talk about that, because it's a good thing to talk about of how we're involved in all of this. Let's take a break and we will return to the conversation. As always, we welcome your letters. We have quite a few and we'll get to more. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we have Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Angie Cheung, and Jim Hendler up this morning. We'll continue our conversation after this break. You must have known that. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Angie Cheung, and Jim Hendler with us this morning. We, before break, Angie brought up a great point about why we are hoarding stuff and why a lot of the problems that we're having due to the gasoline shortages is because people are buying so much gasoline and worried that what we hope is a short-term problem could become a long-term problem. And bringing up the very good point of, you know, addressing that, we saw it with toilet paper, we saw it throughout the early days and months of the pandemic. Angie, did you have more? Do you have a thought on that, of what causes that in us?
Well, you know, right now it's speculation, certainly, but I think that for, you know, certainly the past year has been very trying and has really raised a lot of insecurity and stress. And, you know, we've always had this issue with social media kind of running the show when it comes to our society. And so I think that combined with what's been going on the past year, you know, it's kind of like to each their own, right? They go after whatever they can to save themselves in case, you know, Armageddon strikes. So I think that's part of the issue here.
Alan?
Well, I agree with Angie, and I'm a perfect example of it. And I shamefacedly say it. As soon as this thing struck, I got up real early yesterday morning and ran out to the Great Barrington station that I use. There was no one there.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that it really has become, you know, sort of sectional in terms of who's getting what. But yeah, for those of us who are a little bit older and who have lived through gas shortages before and remember those lines and people getting into fights which ended up in disaster, you know, it was all too real to me. And that's why I'm glad Angie's here, because she's the sociologist.
I'm wondering if the panel knows, and I'm not exactly sure, if the increased need to for cybersecurity measures is considered in the Biden infrastructure package and is one of the things that is not the traditional definition of infrastructure, but As we see just when this instance alone, it's crucial infrastructure to our country that these pipelines and other things that are vulnerable to hacking not be hacked. And I don't know if it is, in fact, included as an infrastructure item, but if not, it ought to be, don't you think?
And hacking Ira. Yeah.
So, I mean, the answer, Ira, is, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, so Ira, in the infrastructure bill, there's some software modernization funds for both broadband and for some other things, including some of the cyber infrastructure, I believe. And in that, included in the things that are covered is some cybersecurity, but it will probably get a separate investment through some of these different means. But I did want to say, you know, while we were talking about sociology, you know, when it comes to cyber, I have the easy job, right? That's like being the vaccine scientist who has to develop the vaccine. The sociologists have the hard
You're
part,
right. That is people busy. To it.
But it's the sociologists who have the hard part, which is getting it into people's arms, getting people to be willing to take it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's really very much what a lot of us believe is the really hard part on cybersecurity, is getting people to understand it, take it seriously, do the right thing, change their behaviors, like just clicking on links that cause these problems, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent analogy. I think with the vaccines, we're having that problem, right? There are countries out there who have no access to supplies that are desperately trying to get it, and we're still hesitant about, you know, using this. I wonder also to what extent, if we had a political scientist here, too, if
Alan?
This kind of, Alan, I think with
I didn't know if that was pointed or not.
Yeah. No, he's big. If we had a, he's big.
If we had
right
a real political
mixture.
Science.
No, no, yeah. I don't think so. Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
No. I didn't do my research clearly.
go ahead,
but the past 4 or 5 years, if this tendency towards conspiracy theories has been, you know, increasing because of the message that we've been getting from above, right? You think that people are now even, you know, with the vaccines, with cybersecurity, with, you know, espionage, all these things, we've become a paranoid society in some ways?
Well, look, we had an ex-president, a former president of the United States, who from the very top knew what his audience was and played to that audience. These are people, and you know this as well as I do, Angie, that's for sure, these are people who do not want to give up power in this country. And as a result of that, they are doing anything they can to put a stop to losing power to people of color, to people who are poorer, but it's happening. And so it's an act of desperation. People are believing it. They want to believe it. And in their own minds, they have to believe it. And to me, that's the dividing line on our contemporary politics. On the one hand, we have, you know, we have the Trumpers lying, telling terrible fibs and doing the rest of it. And yet there are some people, and I keep hitting myself on the side of my head about this, who really believe that stuff. They do. And why they do is probably fits into what you've just announced or said.
Well, and if I can interject this from the media point of view, you have media of all types reporting on what is going on, but they're not necessarily reporting it the same way. So that if you have, in this particular case, the far-right media blaming this on Biden and buttressing the concerns of those who are fearful they're not going to have any gas to drive their cars, they're going to emphasize that for their audience, and their audience is going to react accordingly. So that the same factors, but from a different direction, as Alan just described, with from the political science direction.
And then what do you, yeah, and then what do you do about, like, we're worried, somebody used the, who used the word paranoia? Was that you, Angie?
Yes, Angie did.
Yeah.
I think it was me.
And I think that's,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, that seems really key, right, of how we're very worried about these. I asked this question yesterday, but, you know, it's we're worried about everything except, like, getting a vaccine. I don't know. That's odd to me, but we'll figure that out at another time. We got a lot of letters. Michael says, does anyone know how the pipeline ransomware was actually resolved? Was the ransom paid? Jim?
Exactly. They say it wasn't. Right,
there's been, yeah, there. Well, you know, the government didn't say anything, so people thought that meant they did pay it. And then the company didn't explicitly say they didn't pay it, but they hinted they didn't pay it. So it's one of those things where people are just not really sure. It seems like if they did pay something, they certainly didn't pay the whole thing.
Well, why should they say they paid it? It would only encourage other people to do same thing.
Sure. Do we know the amount?
Yeah.
Jim, do we know the amount that was asked? The exact amount?
I don't think that was made public. If it is, I haven't seen it.
We go to...
Bless Mr. Google, won't we?
Yeah, you do that. I'll do this. Carrie says, I believe it's been documented that people don't hoard toilet paper in the early days, didn't hoard toilet paper in the early days of the pandemic. The lack of toilet paper was due to the fact that people were no longer going to the bathroom at workplaces. Well, this I've never heard. So there was more demand for toilet paper packaged for the home. Toilet paper for businesses is packaged in a different way, and there was plenty of that at the start of the pandemic. All right. I don't know about that one way or the other. Let's see. We go to Kathy this week. From Sunday through Wednesday, no noticeable lines at gas stations, but the price of regular with credit card went from $2.85 to $2.95.
Leading to Alan's earlier observation, somebody's making money.
Right. My brother, who lives in the South, was telling me there were some stations that they were trying to shut down because they were charging $7 or $8 a gallon. Mike Wrightson says, I believe that depending on product, they push the fuels down the pipe and they are then routed to the tank farms at the end point. The gas in the pipes comes from refiners and the basic stock is combined from all refiners. The difference comes in the additives blended in the tank. In the tank farm when being batched into tank trucks for delivery to the end points.
A little bit pretty much what Ira said before, yeah. Didn't you, Ira? Yeah.
Yes. Well, he didn't use the word tank farm, unfortunately, though.
Yes. There's the refineries, then the refined stuff gets put in, and then they go to these places where they go into all these tanks where then, as they go into the various trucks and things are added. So, yeah.
Additives.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Teachers! Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Moving on with topics, President Biden met on Wednesday with Republican and Democratic leaders from both houses of Congress for the first time since taking office, but the discussion appeared to make only modest progress toward resolving disagreements on Mr. Biden's proposals to spend $4 trillion on infrastructure and families. The closed-door meeting at the White House included Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and the majority leader. Senator Mitch McConnell was there, as was Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy, who moments before that meeting was overseeing the ouster of Liz Cheney. As the group assembled in the Oval Office, Mr. Biden told reporters that he hoped to find common ground on infrastructure spending. He joked that he would like to just snap my fingers to achieve that goal despite fierce Republican opposition to his plans. The bottom line here is we're going to see whether we can reach some consensus on a compromise. We're going to talk a lot about infrastructure. After the 90-minute meeting ended, the Republican leaders said it had been productive, but both McConnell and Mr. McCarthy said they remained unwilling to consider any of the tax increases that Mr. Biden has suggested to pay for the spending. Mr. McCarthy said, you won't find any Republicans going to go raise taxes. Alan. All right, I've lost Alan. Ira.
No, there,
oh,
right.
There you are.
You need to,
there you go.
Yeah, but
here's
Ira
what you
can
need to
go.
Know
sure.
About McCarthy, if we didn't know it already, he went out to the front of the White House and said more or less it was a productive meeting and all of the things that you described with the caveats he mentioned. And then later in the day, under his name came a fundraising missive calling Biden corrupt Joe Biden, and he's pushing his socialist agenda. McCarthy is giving is rewriting the definition of McCarthyism in our political discourse, and the guy can't be trusted. He strikes me as a lightweight. He strikes me as in over his head, and it's just an indication of where the Republican Party has gone. That this man is actually in line to be the speaker if they somehow should take the House over next year.
Mm. And Ira, don't you think there's a possibility that he heard from the White House subsequent to his, we had a productive meeting, he walks out of there. A couple of hours later, the guy is saying, you know, calling names and pointing fingers and doing all that
stuff. You mean
stuff.
From Sounds the former Trump- White House?
Yes.
I think that's
sorry,
a possibility.
Yes.
The strings, but talk about the pipeline going from the South to New York. You've got the strings going from Florida into Washington.
Yeah. Jim.
Of that there's no doubt.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, you had the morning McCarthy engineers throwing over Cheney without even being able to have a secret ballot. Then by the afternoon, he and McConnell were out in the Rose Garden saying, oh, no, no, the election's over, Biden's president. And then he's back on Fox last night, you know, conspiracy again. I mean, he has no core anything, which unfortunately is
well, I've
to be
said this
becoming,
before no, on, you're this, wrong. On this program. I think the people who think the Republican voters in this country are stupid are not non-Republicans, but the Republican leadership, because they're dishing out all this crap to them, fully expecting them to swallow it, and the numbers are most of the Republicans are swallowing it.
Yeah. Well. Anyway.
Although slowly shift.
I sort of forgot what I was going to say, Jim, but you said something that struck me as not being right, but I don't or I don't remember what it was. So I'll just have to let that one go. Sorry.
Angie.
Yeah, I mean, I think I ask myself a lot of how many of them actually believe what they say. And I do think that they're trying to pander to two different constituencies within the Republican Party in some ways. Right. You have. Certainly the whole fiasco with Liz Cheney, right, that you have this kind of old school Republican versus Trump Republicans. And I think they're trying to get the best of both worlds. And I just think that our only hope is that some of these contradictions that they're kind of spinning out will be obvious. But I think also the other problem has to be, you know, which media they're consuming, right? They can spin out whatever they want to the public. And I don't know. It's just. Yeah.
But Angie, don't you think they're digging their own graves? Look, we know what the polling is saying now. Somebody will write in and say, poll schmoles. It doesn't matter. But we know that right now Trump tracks around 30% in terms of his approval rating. And we know that Biden is at 63. Now they get together and they have a choice, these people. Do I save myself or do I save the country? If I choose to save myself, then I got to do whatever Trump tells me to do. And I think that's what we just saw with McCarthy, you know, bending over backwards to do exactly what he was told by this guy. So I think from a Democratic point of view, particularly national elections and senatorial elections, this is good stuff for them. On the other hand, so many of these districts have been so gerrymandered in some of these states that it's going to be very hard to beat them no matter how the Republicans commit seppuku.
Right. I you know, Alan, I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, they are trying to pander to two kind of perspectives, but I do think that if you look at what's going on with certainly maybe not in the short term, but in the long term, there were some numbers that came out from Pew about the partisan generational partisan affiliations over time. And the new generation that's coming up is certainly not going to feed into all this BS, if I could put it gently. But I think that, I sit here wondering why they are holding on to this type of thought process. I don't know if you have thoughts on this.
It's easy.
Why they think they have to pander to them.
Well, that's easy. Trump has made it clear, anybody who disagrees with me, and that's why Cheney becomes very important in all of this from his perspective, will get the axe. I'll give him the axe. And they say, no, I want to be a congressman or I want to be a senator. And they don't dare deviate. It's that simple. They are cowards of the worst order, and they're selling out our American democracy in doing it.
And I think the axe is not so much, you know, so Trump putting up, you know, endorsing your opponent hasn't shown up as the big thing, but Trump telling his people to stay home, right? Because that 30% becomes a very strong voting block. If you tell them, don't vote for this guy, and, you know, they don't come out, you know, that's a lost election. So you're absolutely right, Alan. You know, he's just holding his party for ransom.
I do want to read this one part of the of an article about this subject on infrastructure in the meeting that took place yesterday. McCarthy and McConnell said their membership remained at odds with the president about how to define infrastructure and infrastructure spending. Republicans have balked at Mr. Biden's $2.3 trillion American Jobs Plan, which would increase spending on home health aides, colleges, and broadband, as well as more traditional infrastructure targets like roads and bridges. McCarthy said, we first have to start with a definition of what is infrastructure. That's not home health. That's roads, bridges, highways, airports, broadband. Mr. McConnell told reporters that he hoped Senate committees would handle the president's proposals through the normal legislative process, which could increase the chances of a deal. Returning to the Capitol, Democratic leaders framed the meeting as a modest sign of progress. But that idea of having to define what infrastructure is.
Well, I think the President Biden put threw everything into the kettle that he possibly could have. And he said from day one, I'm willing to compromise. I think the Republicans are making a point which a lot of independents, forget about Democrats, will accept. Which is, we can do this, but infrastructure is infrastructure and should be so defined. And if you want to do something else, well, then do it separately in separate bills. Nevertheless, as I say, Biden keeps saying, I'm willing to compromise.
I want to go to a couple of letters on some subjects that we've talked about. We have just about a minute before we have to go to a break, so just get to a couple of letters. One on infrastructure from Michael. What's missing from this discussion is the fact that Biden campaigned on proposing $7 trillion to fix our infrastructure instead of starting with that wholly insufficient amount for infrastructure that's been ignored by both parties for decades. Biden's negotiated himself down. The fact is that infrastructure improvement maintenance pays for itself many times over. Then Rolf writes about the ransomware payment. The reason that the ransom is often paid is that the insurance company involved insists that it would rather pay up. The reason is that it's cheaper for the insurance company to pay rather than mitigate what could be a long and costly recovery. I believe Adams, Massachusetts was a victim a few years ago, and their insurance carrier paid. Also on
this is.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, that's a very good point, and I won't get into a long discussion, but the economics of this stuff, that's a key point, because who pays when changes.
Right. Bob writes to us and says, I have a new stove that has a computer-controlled oven. I've had to replace these cyber elements twice at $125 per. There is no reason that an oven needs anything but mechanical controls. Computer controls is our zeitgeist. A pipeline and many other critical infrastructures do not truly need these high-tech vulnerable systems. The solution is to simplify and take them offline for security. Oh, Jim, what do you think about that?
He's about half right. I agree with him about the oven. I'm not sure I agree with him about the pipeline.
That's a very good diplomatic answer. All right. I like it.
It would be a long answer when you said we have to go to break in a minute.
Yeah, I know. But I'm curious. All right. Well, let's take a break. We'll be back. We'll have another half hour to talk with our group here, and we will do just that. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll talk about such sexy items as inflation when we come back. First news.
Then that time I went and said goodbye. Now I'm back and not ashamed to cry. Ooh, baby, here I am. I'm still delivered. I'm yours.
usually three reasons that we'll play a particular artist. One is if we want to note something of a new album or something like that. Another is if the person has passed away. And a third is to commemorate a birthday or some notable occasion. So we've gotten at least two letters now asking us, oh, my God, has Stevie Wonder died? No, he hasn't. He is very much alive and doing well. We just were playing it because it's his 71st birthday. Just wanted to make that clear. You can see the entire playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. A lot of letters we want to clean up, and then we'll move on to some other subjects before we go at 11:30. At 10:30, and then Dr. Jim Fagan is going to join us, pediatric immunologist, and we'll be talking about COVID and all the news there, especially with a new vaccine for adolescents. Mike writes, regarding the previous writer's letter, getting rid of the sophisticated controls would at least make this a jobs issue. Get rid of the remote controls, put a human operator at each valve station, and let them operate all the controls. Jim, there's your opportunity to go longer on the first question.
So, you know, Joe, we can talk about pipelines, things like that, but you still have to communicate with those people. They still have to coordinate. You can do that at human speeds or computer speeds. If you can do it at computer speeds, you can prevent all sorts of potential problems. That's why we've moved to computer control. You can monitor what's going on. So I sat in a facility up in Washington State watching reports on all of the energy consumption around the entire U.S., you know, as a single number changing over time. You could watch fluctuations, you could drill down. You know, it's right. A wonderful thing to be able to monitor like that. Same time, the things that make it so you can do that, those sensors, those effectors, the infrastructure and the computers that do that, have these vulnerabilities. So again, this is all trade-offs. We could get rid of all this stuff, but, you know, that's like saying, you know, cars have accidents, let's get rid of cars and go back to horse and buggy. Well, that's fine if you don't want to go very far. So, you know, again, these things have to be viewed as trade-offs, not as one thing or the other. And that's what makes it tricky. Part of what makes it tricky.
Chris writes to us and says, the stupid Trump Republicans don't realize they already have the power to do the work they were elected to do. They don't need Trump. They are the Congress with the power to do the work of the people now. If they could get their heads out of their, you know. Yes. And do what's right, they wouldn't have to worry about losing their seats. Interesting.
How else but stupid can you explain, we may still get to it today, the comments about the insurrection being nothing short of tourists going through the Capitol. I mean, they can see with their own eyes what happened, and now they're trying to be convinced that these are tourists. I mean, it's laughable if it wasn't so sad. And if the people are gullible enough to believe it, then they're stupid.
Isn't it like if you shut your eyes and you just say January 6th, isn't the image that you just see of the large picture of the Capitol building with people like just climbing up the walls, storming the place
and busting the windows and
shots being fired and death and I just. And then to have someone who is an elected member of the Congress to say, oh, well, you know, they were walking between the stanchions. And if you look at it, it's really nothing more than a school group walking through the Capitol corridors.
Well, and then the line is all the people who were hurt were the protesters, not the defenders. I'm like, tell that to the dead cops and to the
Capitol
police.
Tell that to Officer Sicknick.
Maybe they were selling clubs and axes at the gift shop for this group of tourists.
Andrew, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
The Capitol gift shop.
Angie, we're going to say something. I thought you were going to say something. I'm sorry.
No.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I was going to actually say something. I want everybody to take one step back and forget about, you know, not only what they did, but to understand that the American democracy, whatever there is of it, is being sold out by these terrible people. And I mean terrible, because, you know, Think of all the world wars that were fought, all of the progress we have made in this country, and these people are selling out our concept of free and fair elections. And for that, they really ought to be ashamed. It's no more than that.
Jim?
Sorry, all I can say is I agree with Al.
Okay. I thought you were going to say something.
You may have seen, I think it was on Bill Maher, the representative from Michigan, Slotkin, and I don't know if this is an original comment of hers or she's parroting someone else, but she said the Republicans have no shame. I'd rather say no truth, no facts, no shame, and I think that capsulizes it.
The rewriting of history is, it's certainly nothing new, and we've seen this, but to something, you know, it's only the 13th of May. This happened on January 6th. This wasn't really all that long ago. It's still very much alive, and Ira, I'm struck by what you said at the very beginning of what other word is there than stupid, and I hate using that word, but you just wonder, like, who buys that? And it's hard to
73 million people bought it.
I know. It's just really hard to
the former white majority in this country. That's what it was. And that's who they are. And they are desperately clinging on to power so that they can continue to do the same things that we have seen that has resulted in the racism that we have in this country. It's just so sad.
Valerie writes, the divide on the definition of infrastructure is sexist. Republicans want to continue to ignore on the unpaid labor of women. As a mother in healthcare, I struggle and feel ignored. Angie, any thoughts on that argument?
I'm actually trying to understand the context. So the writer is saying that.
The writer is saying that we were talking about earlier, there was I read a statement from Kevin McCarthy in which he was saying it all had to do with the definition of infrastructure. And I'm just pulling this out of my brain, so if I get
it not
completely correct. But they were saying it's roads and bridges. It isn't health care. It isn't health workers. It's infrastructure, or it isn't broadband. It's roads and bridges. And Valeria is making the point that the divide on that definition is sexist.
That is an excellent point, and that did not even cross my mind. But I think that, clearly they would rather spend on things that have less to do with caregiving, and clearly those caregivers are oftentimes women. And so I do think that, it's a great point. I think there's that aspect, and, you know, we have to ask why they are siding with certain issues and not others, and gender is certainly a part of that.
Kathleen makes a similar point, saying the Republicans don't want to spend money on home health care because it's considered women's work. The Republicans miss no opportunity to be misogynists. Then on the issue of Kevin McCarthy becoming the next House Speaker, David says that idea is bolstered by the fact that Republican states are gaining 3 House seats based on the census. All right. In our few moments here, let's go to some other subjects. And that, of course, is the ongoing debate over inflation. The increase, there's a jump in the consumer price, which raises stakes in the inflation debate. The increase in the Labor Department's consumer price index was well above forecasts. A top Fed official acknowledged the surprise, but said this is one data point. Consumer prices jumped at the fastest pace in more than a decade in April, surprising economists and intensifying a debate on Wall Street and in Washington over whether inflation might reach levels that would squeeze households and ultimately undermine the recovery. On Wednesday, stocks slumped more than 2%, their biggest decline since late February, after the government reported in the morning that the closely monitored consumer price index climbed 4.2% in April from a year earlier, its fastest pace since 2008. Economists and central bank officials said the numbers reflected pandemic-driven trends that would most likely prove temporary, but investors and politicians are worried that prices will keep climbing, potentially pressuring the Federal Reserve to lift interest rates sharply. That could slow economic growth and send stock prices plummeting. Alan.
Very troublesome. And I know that the White House knows that it's troublesome. it is a way in which Biden, who is doing very well in terms of polling among the American people, can lose a great deal. Look, one and one makes two. If you're going to spend a lot of money, you got to figure out a way to pay for it. Not only that, you got to confront some ugly truths. I got yelled at the other day on the panel. I tend to remember these things because I even raised the question whether unemployment insurance is leading to this. I got yelled at. Soon thereafter, the president of the United States, Joe Biden, came out and he said, if you have if we don't want to catch you, you know, getting unemployment if you haven't tried to get a job. So that means they know that this is important. I had a relative, a distant relative, who was a superb professional, and he got canned at a job, and he was out. This was quite a while ago. He was out for a long time, and it was one of those periods where they kept extending unemployment benefits, and they kept making them longer and longer. Well, he went along with it each time. He was a professional, as I say. He was very much, he was an accountant. He was very much able to do what he wanted. And then what happened was, the day that they ended it, finally, the day that they ended it, he got another job. You know, I mean, we liberals don't like to acknowledge certain things, but that is an issue. I know I'll get it for this, but just the way it is.
Well, I mean, I think... you know, I certainly think we need to keep an eye on it. This isn't something we want to do in the long term. But don't you think that, I mean, we're dealing with a very difficult situation. It almost reminds me of what former President Obama was dealing with a huge recession when he came into office. And this is even worse because we've had a full year of economic stagnation. You know, we need to find a way to support those who went backwards. And part of that involves the domestic spending package, and part of that involves addressing inequality. So I think that we're dealing with a huge challenge. And this isn't to say that I'm not concerned with the numbers, but this is really just the start of trying to restart the economy, right? But I do agree with Alan in the sense that, you know, this is not something we want to depend on. I know people who don't even want to go back to the office. So they're considering, you know, relying on unemployment for that, right? But I do think, I agree with you. I think once we are able to restart things and have hopefully people vaccinated and open businesses, you know, we can start scaling back, right? But this is a really big issue right now.
Jim?
So, yeah, I'm just a simple data scientist, not an economist. So I'm very confused because I listen to these very different reports. So in the BBC thing we just heard, we heard about fast food restaurants raising their pay because they can't hire enough people. So I don't think the problem is this preference for unemployment. I think we're seeing big changes in the patterns. I think we're seeing different people in the workforce. You know, it was mentioned the women's issue before. You know, I know a lot of women are saying they're having trouble re-entering the workforce before their kids are back in school, things like that. So, you know, I think this is a very complicated issue, and I'd really like, you know, I'm looking forward tomorrow hearing what Aaron Bassetti, if he's going to be on, has to say, because this seems like, it just seems very contradictory. We're hearing simultaneously that, you know, no one can get jobs and that employers can't hire people and all these different trends. And I'd just really like to know, you know, can anybody figure out what's happening?
Aaron is not scheduled to be on tomorrow, I'll see if I can work with his agent and see what we can do.
Next time.
If I can jump in, I was off for a minute, so I didn't hear some of the comments. But like Jim, I'm not an economist. I'm just a simple retired newspaper person. But it just strikes me that the situation that the country is in right now economically is that of being in uncharted waters. I mean, you have such a huge impact from the pandemic, something that had not been experienced in 100 plus years. And there's a volatility that's going to naturally result. I mean, you've got they were virtually giving away airline tickets for about a year. And now the airlines are making up for it. There's a demand for tickets, and the prices are way up. There are other goods and services similarly impacted. I'm not yet prepared. The numbers will speak for themselves, whether they're, you know, whether we're officially in an inflation. But I just sort of have the sense that if we are, it won't be a long one, because the natural order of things are going to balance out to where they were more likely before the pandemic.
And when you look at this information of Alan, as I said at the beginning, you know, the debate over inflation and this concern, and of course Janet Yellen caught some of this in a interview that she gave, I believe, with The Atlantic. So where does the debate go, and how does anyone win that?
Well, I think the numbers are going to tell everything. Are going to tell a great deal. And by the way, you know, for all of us who are pushing this stuff around, it's not either or. It's not one way or the other. I talk to a lot of people who own businesses who cannot get the people back who were working in those businesses, including a lot of men, okay? Just so let's say it's not really all about women and child care. Look, this is gonna take some real doing. Do I think that people will go where it is easiest to go in terms of their economic situation? I do, and I apologize for saying it, but I think that's the nature of the beast. And I think that's what we're going to be seeing until some basic changes are made, including the amount of money that is given out for those people who are out of work.
Meaning the supplement.
Well, no, not only the supplement, but meaning that
minimum
that
wage.
You are, no.
I'm missing both of them. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. My fault and my inarticulateness. No, we are giving people money not to work. Basically, we are saying, okay, you were working. Now we're going to give you unemployment insurance.
Well, you get unemployment, and then they're getting the extra $300.
Yeah,
that's the supplement.
That's right.
That's the supplement.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, that's right. But that will change. But right now, we don't want to change it. And you hear we don't want to change it from the people who are writing us and telling us that this is the way it should be. But hey, you know, if Biden is to be reelected, he can't have this millstone hanging around his neck, especially if there's provable unemployment. If there's provable rise in the way in which what money is worth.
Angie?
Yeah, I mean, I agree on this. The sense that certainly the minimum wage issue is relevant. I was thinking about the comment you made, though, also about women not being able to go back to work. And, you know, certainly the schools have not fully reopened. They are starting to, depending on the region you're in. But, you know, it's nearly impossible for many of us to, you know, go back to office like things are the same while our children are still at home. So I think and I wanted to what extent I think it'd be interesting to explore to what extent the stress, anxiety, depression, you know, deaths in our family, all these things have also impacted our ability to really go back to normal, right? You know, I'm sure there's an economic aspect to it, but I do think that would be worth exploring. I mean, you know, we act like because things are opening up, you know, people can just go back to our lives before, but I don't think that's really the case right now.
No, it's going to be tough. And by the way, just in terms of the right of reply, I don't want anybody to think I said that women should go back to work who can't or where child care isn't. But I did mention the difference between the sexes. And I did mention, Angie, that I know plenty of employers who had men working for them and they won't come back. And the point of that was the various benefits that the government is giving out. I don't want to sound like a conservative, but that's where I am.
Jim?
I don't have anything to add at this point.
Can we go back to cybersecurity? Yeah, about whether or not the Unemployment Bureau is asking people if they're out looking for work and having them prove that they're looking for work. That's historically what has happened when there's unemployment insurance issued. I don't know that that's going on right now.
Well, the president said it was. Biden made
he said
that
it
point.
It was or wasn't?
It was. He said, we don't want to find people going out, and you shouldn't go out and look for work and not look for work. You should be looking for work. And basically, if we find out about it, it won't be good. So
right.
I think he did say that. And I think it if he says it as a semi-liberal president, I guess it's pretty good proof that that's what's going on. Hey, at WAMC, we have had a regular group of people who would come in and they would ask for our employment forms, and they would fill out those forms, as anybody should do. And we knew what that was about. This was because people were looking to prove to the people that they were reporting to that they were looking for work. But were they really looking for work? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few moments. I want to go to some of the letters that we have left over here. And again, at 10:30, right after the news, we're going to be going to talk to Dr. Jim Fagan. And we'll be talking about COVID and the vaccines, and we welcome your letters on that. So Jim writes, when can we start educating the public and the news media that the stock market is not mainstream economics? I have never understood how these so-called pundits can say the market moved because of one thing. I mean, who is that dude who makes the decision that states the cause of market movement? I believe he/she is just a tool of the market to sway public opinion. We go to this letter from Tracy. I wonder what the numbers show when it comes to those who have collected unemployment unfairly and the money we have lost due to non-taxation, a loophole of the wealthy. I'd prefer supporting the former rather than the latter. Erica says the inflation argument is moot. Name a time when inflation wrecked the economy. I also take issue with the negativity around the jobs report. People had to become self-sufficient during this past year. Maybe they started their own business or decided that having lots of money is overrated and quality of life is more important. Let's see. Jean-Marc says it would be worth mentioning how often the United States Congress has often sacrificed the principles of democracy in order to secure to power for a, yes, white majority at the expense of African Americans. Dr. Ibram Kendi explains this very well, necessary reading. And Dr. Kendi has been a guest on this program, has been on our panel, and certainly point well made. Let's see. We also go to, I think I have time for at least two more letters. We go to Anthony, who says, perhaps people have realized that working 40 more hours a week at a job that pays less than minimum wage and doesn't allow for a decent life isn't as desirable as unemployment insurance. It's time corporate America valued people and paid a living wage. A full-time job should yield a living wage for anyone and everyone. Then people will go back to work. And final letter, I think the solution for high prices are high prices. I've seen more lumber and scrap metal trucks driving on the thruway than I've seen in over a decade. There are supply constraints due to COVID affecting output, not because of hyper demand. I would be much more worried about falling prices as we reopen the economies. It will take time for lumber, steel, and other products to be processed into finished products. Prices and inflation will come down. Similar to what you were saying just a few moments ago, Ira.
And Joe, may I just take a moment of personal privilege to congratulate our wonderful Terry Harrison, who was responsible for getting us Rosemary or Mayo on the air. And she is retiring from SUNY. And
Terry
she
is.
Was my chick.
Yep.
Terry is.
Yep.
Yes, Terry. And she is just one wonderful example of what a great leader, academic leader, can be.
Terrific. Congratulations to her panel, at least Ira, Angie, and Jim. Thank you very much for being with us. Very good to have you on this morning. I appreciate your comments and time.
Thank you, Joe.
Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jim. Good luck with everything. Okay, coming up next, Alan and I will be back with Dr. Jim Fagan, pediatric immunologist. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org.
I got empty pockets. You see, I'm a poor man, son. Can't give other things that money can buy. But I never make my baby cry. And it's all
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are very pleased to welcome to the conversation Dr. Jim Fagan. He is a pediatric immunologist, has been with us all over the course of this pandemic to help us understand some of the big stories in the news regarding COVID, coronavirus, and the vaccinations, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the program this morning. Jim, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's nice to be back, Joe.
So I guess the big news, and we'll start off with this, is the vaccinations of 12 to 15 years old now underway in many parts of the country, soon to be here in New York State. Certainly as a pediatrician, I assume this is something that is nothing but good news in your department.
It's wonderful news. It's what we've been really waiting for a long time. And I'm very, very pleased that the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices cleared the vaccine for the 12 to 15 year age. But they're also working on, the younger kids also, which is going to be very important. I know both Pfizer and Moderna are looking at the 2 to 11 year age group as well. But, we're real excited about the fact that we can now vaccinate these adolescents. It's going to really add a lot in terms of just the general feeling of these kids going back to school in the fall, knowing that they will have been vaccinated. It's something that we've been looking forward to for a long time. So, yeah, we're very excited about it.
So is there an analogy between this and what we did when we went through with polio with the kids?
Well, obviously there is an analogy because polio was a very infectious disease that was devastating, young children many, many years ago. And you probably, like me, remember, getting, the polio shot.
It hurt.
I think we got them in school and we all lined up. They took the whole class down to the nurse's office and we got our polio shot. But yeah, I mean, vaccinations have had a major, major, major impact on the health and well-being of all of us, and especially children. If you look at the, the childhood vaccines, measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, it's just incredible. What the impact that these vaccines have had, and we're certainly very hopeful that the COVID-19 vaccines will have a similar effect.
So what took so long?
Well, I would argue, how'd they do it so quickly?
Most
vaccine development takes years. It really, 3 or 4 years. We all know that. The development of the COVID-19 vaccines, the messenger RNA vaccines, was, the development of those vaccines was really expedited.
No, Jim, I meant with the kids.
Why did it take to
get to the kids in terms of where their priorities were?
Well, the issue with the kids is that it's always safety and effectiveness. You want to make sure that children are not just little adults, and their immune systems are different or in a different stage of development. You want to make sure that when you give a new vaccination, that number one, it's effective, and also number one, that it's very, very safe. So the safety issues were very important, and it was like almost every other vaccine that's developed, if it's a vaccine that's not specifically for children, you always want to test it in the adult population first, and then you go down decrementally. So you go from an adult would be 18 and older. The Pfizer vaccine can actually be given to 16-year-olds. And then you want to look at the younger age groups because as you get to the – so they would look at the 12 to 15 – and then probably maybe the 6 to 11 and 2 to 5 and then 6 months to 2 years of age. And as you get to the younger children, the dosing may be somewhat different. I would not be surprised if the dosing for a 6-month old is probably half of what it is for an adult. But those are the kinds of things that need to be studied. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you don't start out with the kids, you start out with the adults for safety issues.
So my understanding, just to clarify this for, well, for myself, but also for our listeners, the vaccine so far that has been approved is just Pfizer, right? And it is the same vaccine, I got Pfizer, so it's the same vaccine that I would have gotten, right?
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Okay. So one of the things that is exciting about this is that now the largest, I believe, teachers union says that they're ready to open up, that they can now go full speed ahead for school in the fall because of this decision. What do you make of that? And I guess, you know, we were going to talk about college kids too, but certainly when it comes to schools. And then I'll give you the bonus question, which is really the stinker in the mix, which is, and how do you make sure the kids actually get vaccinated?
Well, in terms of the impact on schools, it's going to be enormous. And we're talking 12 to 15 year old kids. So you're talking about you know, middle school, high school. To get those kids vaccinated is going to have a major impact on really the sense of security that everyone feels in terms of sending the kids back to school in the fall. And I'm fairly confident that the 5 to 11 group will be ready by September as well. So I'm hopeful that by early fall, we'll be able to vaccinate kids as young as 5 years of age. So now we're talking about kindergarten, you know, right up through, the senior in high school and beyond. And so that, you know, that would be wonderful if we were able to do that. The second question was about, what was your second question?
The second question was about how do schools, so we're going to welcome vaccinated kids back to school. We're hearing this in a lot of colleges. How do you make sure that the kids actually get vaccinated? Will there be the same hesitancy there that there is in the adult population?
Yeah. You know, the issue is really, Joe, can you mandate that kids be vaccinated before entering school? And, you know, that's, you know, that whether or not you can do that, that's not the federal government that's going to do that. It's the state governments that have the power to mandate that. And I would, you know, as a pediatric immunologist, I would love that because I think it's so important for each kid's health and well-being as well as the general population. I would love it if that were mandated. There may be issues because you have to remember this is still a vaccine that is authorized under emergency use. It's not given a general approval by the FDA yet. It's going to be a lot easier to mandate, you know, that kids get vaccinated once it is approved as by the FDA, not just an emergency use approval. But how do you guarantee that someone's been vaccinated? You can ask to see their vaccination card.
Right.
You know, and New York State has a vaccination, you know, wallet that you can put in your cell phone.
Passport. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there are vaccination passport, they call it exactly. So there are ways, you know, that we have to document that someone's been vaccinated.
Are you, that proof obviously is important. And I guess I'm getting back to the question of, so let's go over to the hesitancy that still exists within the adult population. So the latest numbers that I have found, and you know, give or take, right, 154 million people vaccinated, 55% of the eligible population, 12 and older, and 46.4% of the total population. Is that good enough, and what do we do to up those numbers?
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful, but no, it's not good enough. You know, we talked about herd immunity before on the show, and it looks like the concept of herd immunity is something that we probably will not be able to achieve just because of the number of people around the globe who have contracted this infection. You know, it's important. We don't, you know, live in a bubble in the United States, and what's happening in India will have an impact on, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States to a certain extent. And the concept of herd immunity was that we would have to vaccinate roughly around 80%. Well, do it have to be around 80% of the population of the United States immune to COVID-19, either through vaccination or by acquiring the infection? And although the numbers in terms of vaccinations are wonderful, I mean, I'm thrilled at how many people are getting vaccinated, you know, we're not at that point where it looks like we're going to be able to achieve this herd immunity. But what we want to do is make sure that at least 75-80% of the country still gets vaccinated, because it's going to have a major impact on the spread of the virus. If the virus, you know, can't spread rapidly throughout the population because many people are immunized or immune to the virus, then it's really going to limit, obviously, numbers of infections, and will also limit, importantly, the emergence of new variants, which is another, you know, topic that we're concerned about. But I think that we have to now really focus on those folks who continue to have vaccine hesitancy for whatever reason. You know, they're going to be individuals who absolutely are adamantly opposed to getting vaccinated. And there's nothing that you can do or say. They don't want to get vaccinated, and it's their right not to get vaccinated, if they choose not to. I think it's a mistake, for them personally as well as their families and for the community. But then there are many individuals who are just nervous about it. And I think we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to that, especially now that we're able to starting to vaccinate the kids. Because, a parent may say, well, look, I don't mind getting the vaccination for myself, but, when it comes to my kids, I'm a little cautious. This is, emergency use. So right. There may be issues there. And I think it's going to be very, very important for everyone to be able to communicate effectively with those individuals and just reassuring them that this vaccine is exceptionally safe in kids. The study that was done that Pfizer looked at in their clinical trials for the 12 to 15 year group, they looked at 2,300 adolescents. Half of them received the placebo and half received the active vaccine. And what they discovered was the immune response in these teenagers was considerably stronger than the immune response documented in adults who had been vaccinated. Mm. Now, as a pediatric immunologist, I'm not surprised at that, because children in general have a much more robust response. Their immune system responds more robustly than in older adults. And by the way, in those 2,300 kids, there were 16 cases of COVID-19. Guess what? They were all in the placebo group. Not wow. A single kid in the active immunization group, contracted COVID. So we absolutely have established the efficacy and the safety of the Pfizer vaccine. I have no doubt Moderna will also be accepted for that age group and will have, similar results. So I think the message that we really have to get out to everybody is this is safe and effective for young kids, and it is critically important that we're able to vaccinate these kids.
All right. We just have to take a quick break. And sure, when we come back, we'll get to your question. We have a lot of questions from listeners. We'll do all of that. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. And last call here, we have Dr. Jim Fagan with us. And Alan, you had a question, then we'll go to listener questions.
No, I'd much rather hear the listeners' questions. That's great.
Are you sure? Okay.
I couldn't be sure.
Okay. Here we go. A lot of folks weighing in and have different questions. One of the ones we got a lot on this. So I'm going to take Robert's question and just know there's about 15 other people who asked basically the same thing. Dr. Fagan mentioned that the vaccine has been given an emergency use authorization but is not yet approved. What steps need to be done to make the vaccine approved, and how long should we expect that to take? I assume the steps are being done now.
The steps are definitely being done now. It's really a question of time. The Food and Drug Administration wants to make sure that there's no long-term possible possibility of any long-term side effects, which we know would be extremely unlikely that we're going to see that. So it's really a question of having the vaccine out for a certain period of time, being able to administer a certain number of doses. The strict requirements to be approved to give them general approval by the FDA are different than the emergency use authorization. So you're able to sort of get the EUA without having to go through, the long clinical trials that are necessary for a general approval. So it's really, there's nothing different that's going to be done. It's just a continuation of monitoring, people who are in the clinical trials to make sure that there are no surprises. Very unlikely that there will be, but that's what needs to happen to get a general FDA approval. And it will absolutely happen. I don't know personally when that will happen, but I would probably say certainly within the next 6 months, you're going to see FDA approval for Pfizer, Moderna, and probably J&J.
Should it be the right of the school system, Jim, to say, fine, you have your right, as you said before, but you don't come into school unless you have the vaccine?
I think so, Alan. That's my feeling. Because it isn't just the individual kid or the individual family. It's the entire school. It's the other kids, it's the teachers, it's the staff, it's the administrative staff, it's the custodial staff. It's the bus drivers. It's all these people who are critical, to the function of the everyday function of school. What an individual does impacts on all of that. So yeah. I personally think it is the right. Now, it's going to be up to the states and the districts and the communities to decide this. But I think that they do have the right to mandate that, personally.
The other big question that we have in the mailbag here has to do, and again, I'm just taking one letter that is representative of probably 10 or 12. This one is from Amy, and it has to do with booster shots. As a home health worker, I was in the first phase of vaccination. That means that by September or so, my immunity could dissipate. I have not heard much about booster shots, and we have other people just asking bluntly, will we need booster shots?
Yeah. No, Amy, that's a great question. It's one that we're unable to answer right now, and only time will tell. It will really depend on what is the longevity of immunity after vaccination. We think that there's evidence that the longevity of immunity after vaccination is probably going to be much longer than the immunity after natural infection, which is why we always recommend, even if you had COVID, you still should get vaccinated. You want to wait 90 days after your infection, but you should still get vaccinated because the immune response to the vaccination, it appears, will last a lot longer than the immune response to the infection. Now, how long is a lot longer? We don't know. The honest answer is we don't know yet. As an immunologist, I would say, and our experience with other vaccines, I think it would be very, very likely that immunity to the COVID-19 vaccine will last a number of years. And it could last lifetime, but the question of whether or not we will need a booster will depend on, number one, does the immunity to the vaccine begin to wane after a certain period of time? And if it does, then we may need a booster for that.
So are we seeing anything? Jim, are we seeing anything?
Right now we're not. We are seeing that immunity to the natural infection, it seems to wane after a certain period of time. But immunity to the vaccine, we don't have any evidence that that is waning currently. Now, the other issue in terms of a booster are the variants, and it may be that there may be the emergence of a variant that escapes the antibodies that have been developed as a result of immunization. And if that occurs, then we will need a booster. And by the way, I think Pfizer and Moderna are both working on modifying their messenger RNA vaccine to encompass some of the new variants so that if we do need a booster, they'll have that ready when we need it. The real exciting thing about the messenger RNA vaccine is that you can modify it so easily. You cannot do that with the protein vaccines. The messenger RNA is very easy to sort of change the RNA in the vaccine, which will encode for whatever mutation these variants have. So the question for about booster vaccines, we'll have to wait and see. We don't know yet, but there may be a need for a booster at some point.
So just to be clear, Jim, very quickly, the messenger is Moderna and Pfizer?
Correct. Moderna and Pfizer are the messenger RNA vaccines, yeah.
And the J&J?
J&J is not. That's a adenoviral vector vaccine. It's a different type of vaccination. Yeah.
All right. We only have about 90 seconds, so I just want to quickly ask Paul's question. Four or five members of the New York Yankees have tested positive for the virus in spite of being vaccinated. What's your take on this, says Paul from Slinglands, who was born in the Bronx, and I know that because he said so with 3 exclamation points.
Yeah. So number one is we have to see exactly, when did they get reinfected with respect to when did they get vaccinated. So if they got reinfected, after the first dose or, let's say, a week or so after the second dose, they may not have been fully immunized. Remember, you're not fully immunized until 2 weeks after you complete the second dose, or if it's the J&J, 2 weeks after that one vaccine. So number one is I'm not sure when they actually got these infections. Number two is we know that the goal of the vaccination is to prevent moderate severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And it's almost 100% certainty that you're going to do that with the vaccinations. You may still get, you may still get a positive.
You have a 30-second warning, but go ahead.
Okay, let me just say that a positive test does not mean that you are infectious. And that's a really important point. A positive test may not mean that you are able to transmit the infection. And so that we think may happen in people who are vaccinated. They may test positive but still are unable to transmit the infection. So they're in a different category.
Pediatric immunologist Dr. Jim Fagan, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for your time as always.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Alan, thank you as well.
Thanks, Joe.
Talks tomorrow. Thank you very much. Coming up next, more Roundtable right after this. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.